Welcome to this podcast series on inclusion and education from the University of Leeds. Our research brings together experts in education, childhood and youth studies with an aim to promote equality across family, education, policy, legal and community settings. To read more about our work, please visit the School of Education website. You can find this link and others discussed during the podcast in the programme description.
Hello, my name's Luke McFarlane and welcome to the Inclusion and Education podcast from the University of Leeds. We have a guest today, if you would like to introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, hi Luke. My name's Sarah Cobb and I'm a PGR student in the School of Education and I'm in the final year of my PhD. Now at the moment I'm also employed by the university as an assistant researcher. And I'm supporting a group of lecturers on some research that's related to people's experiences of teaching and learning during the pandemic. And alongside that, I'm also a member of Hillary Place Papers editorial board. My background is in autism. My most recent work was as an advisory teacher, and that's what inspired my PhD.
Yes, and you've recently published a book, haven't you?
Yes, it's called Simple Autism Strategies for Home and School. And it's interesting reflecting on that now, because I wrote that a little while ago. And at the time, that was my, if you like, a collection of my experiences of working as an advisory teacher and my experiences of working with families and with practitioners in primary and secondary schools in a northwest county. And the book puts together those experiences and looks at different elements of the autism spectrum and ways that families and schools can support children or young people in those environments. And it's interesting looking at that and thinking about my research now, because I'm still concentrating on the field of autism, but I'm looking at it from an inclusive point of view and also from the perspective of the practitioners as well. So it's quite interesting to have those two perspectives, if you like.
What is your current research topic on?
The main crux of the research is about, or it's focused on, the practitioners who work with children who are autistic or who have speech, language and communication needs in private day nursery. And more specifically, I'm looking at the way that the staff include the children in their settings, how they get children involved with the activities, and then their views on those practices, how they regard their effectiveness and what it is that they do. In the literature review, I covered an awful lot of ground because I was looking at those different conditions, autism and speech, language and communication needs. I was also looking at early years education. I was looking at private day nurseries. I was also looking at self-efficacy. So I covered an awful lot of ground within that. But what I noticed within the reading was that there was a lot of information out there about that, but nothing that put all of those things together in a particular package of research. And quite often what I was discovering is that the emphasis on practice and best practice was set within a mainstream setting, and there wasn't an awful lot on early years children, and specifically in the sense of those young people with autism or who maybe have autistic traits. So for me, that was a real benefit in terms of producing something that would contribute to the field, because there isn't a lot of research covering all of those headlines.
What are the current issues you see in the private early years sector? To what extent are these issues related to circumstances such as low pay or training?
Well, I think it doesn't take you very long when you look at the literature on early years education to see that it's a sector that is just rich with debates and conversations. Those conversations and challenges are historical. They go back several decades, if not before, and they are very present and they are now. And I say that in the sense that those issues, many of those issues, are relevant to the public and the private sector. in the sense of perhaps what children should be taught at that age, what the purpose of early years education is. But some of those topics are very specific to the private nursery context. And I think professionals and practitioners will differ in terms of their own priorities. But for me, the two things that I was struck by in my reading was the funding arrangements for childcare. I think that's a major topic. And also the status of professionals, how people are viewed as a nursery educator or practitioner. I think they're the two fundamental topics. And because of the complexity of structures and information that's available in the early years sector, I think those two areas will cross over at some point and will link to those themes that you've mentioned about training and staff pay. I mean, when we think about the funding for childcare, you know, in 2017, when the funding formulas were changed in terms of how children could access childcare and the money that would be available to support children in different age groups, there has been an awful lot of discussion since then and ongoing, and it certainly continued during the pandemic. But that funding, it's not just about that funding being available for the children, it's about who accesses that funding. You know, so even if it's there, are children and parents actually taking up those places? I know during the pandemic, from what I've read, the money was still available. Settings were obviously operating on a more limited basis in terms of, you know, who could access it. But even within that, there was an enormous drop in the number of families who were prepared to take up those places. And, you know, when that money's not coming into the setting, when children aren't attending, then that has an impact on obviously the nursery as a whole in terms of their finances, because they work as businesses. And so they're very much reliant on that funding stream that comes in. So when that funding reduces or is not there, then that obviously has implications for the staff who are then employed, for the money that's then available to pay for things like training and so on. So there are lots of elements that come into that, that on the face of it just looks like making sure there's enough money for the children and that children can attend. So, yeah, it has an impact on the viability of the settings. It also then has impacts in terms of the contribution to the economy as well. So, yeah, tremendous overlap in terms of issues that might impinge on. The status of the professionals is huge. You know, I found that really fascinating. I found it fascinating in terms of what I read. And there seems very much to be this sense of the staff who work in the private sector are not viewed as highly as the staff who work in the public sector. So, you know, the staff working in schools, even though essentially they do the same job, might be in a different environment and there might be different sort of structures in terms of how it's organized, but they also are providing education and care for very young children. Historically, there has been this view that if you work in a private nursery and not in a school, then you are not as skilled as staff in a school, you're not as well educated. And of course, that's completely untrue, but there is this perception that prevails. I wondered in my research if I would get a sense of that, if the practitioners themselves would feel that view. And I didn't get that sense, actually. You know, the people that I talked to in my research were very skilled in what they did. They were very well qualified and they were very positive about their experiences as an early years professional. And in some respects, that didn't sit with what I'd read in the literature, which was a nice thing to discover, but almost a little bit of a surprise.
With the staff in your study, their belief of their own self-efficacy seemed universally high. Do you think a lack of reflection can cause issues when trying to apply best practice?
Oh, certainly. I mean, when I was sort of carrying out the research and I was sort of looking at those measurements of their sort of self-efficacy, or rather their belief in their practice, I looked at it in two ways. I looked at it quantitatively, as sort of their response to statements along a scale. So I had this numerical judgment as to how effective they thought they were in different elements of their practice. And then I had this qualitative dimension where I specifically asked for examples during the interviews. And yes, as you say, across the board, there was this common sense of strength in their practice. You know, whatever area we looked at, whether it was tasks and activities relating to the environment, whether it was teaching and learning, staff had a very strong sense of belief in what they were doing was effective. And I think, yes, certainly, if they hadn't got that sort of level of reflection, then that is going to have an impact on their practice. I mean, you look at that, when I sort of hear that question, I think about best practice in two ways. I think about it in terms of the approach itself, you know, what is it that we're doing in the classroom? Is that a good approach? Is that effective? You know, that's one element of practice, the actual practice itself. But then I think about it in terms of the person who's delivering it as well. You know, that actor or agent, if you like, or the member of staff. If you're going to call something best practice, there has to be a judgment involved there, because otherwise, where does that measure come from? How can we call it best practice if we've not made some kind of judgment as to what it is that's good practice and then in contrast what isn't? And that was certainly something that came out in the research. I think if we're not reflecting on what we're doing, there's no sense of progress, there's no sense of improvement. When we were talking about judgments within the interviews, I've got the sense from the staff that they were looking at their practice in two dimensions, and those dimensions were related to the actual groups that they were teaching, whether it was sort of down to that individual child or whether it meant the whole group. And then there was this other dimension too that was about the actual strategies that they used, whether they were specifically related to autism and speech and language challenges, or if they were related to something that was generally to do with nursery education as a whole. And it was very clear for them is that in terms of delivering those practices in the setting, that they were reflecting on their practice, because what they did for one child was different to another. Sometimes there were commonalities and sometimes there were differences. And they couldn't have done that without making those judgments. And I think those discussions and those elements or themes that came out in the data were a reflection of those high levels of judgment. And those judgments affected, you know, the activities that they chose for the children. They affected their levels of motivation, you know, how engaged the staff were themselves with the activity. They reflected on how much effort they put in and their levels of persistence. So it was quite clear from the data to me that there were all these elements and that there was this match between what was measured sort of at an abstract level, if you like, in the questionnaire, with then what was said more personally within the interviews as a series of anecdotes. So I think, yes, a long answer to your short question is yes, it definitely did have an impact, or does have an impact on practice. You do have to reflect.
When this was happening in your research, you were saying that there was two people from the same nursery who were kind of working together, but like they had different roles.
Yeah.
Did you kind of find the perception of what was happening was maybe like slightly skewed depending on where they were employed?
It's interesting you ask that, because that would have been my prediction before the interviews. But in reality, that's not what happened, not in this circumstance or in this situation. I mean, obviously, I couldn't generalize what I found, you know, as a whole. I couldn't say it definitively was the case. But in this circumstance, I found that what the manager said and how she viewed her practice was very similar to the practitioner. And I did find that very interesting. You know, I interviewed them on an individual basis. I sort of talked to one person and then I talked to the other. And they obviously had no idea what, you know, the other person said. But within the course of the interview, they both referenced each other in name. And when I looked at the transcriptions later on, I could see that some of the way that they were phrasing their answers was similar to their colleague as well. You know, things like, you know, being on the same page, you know, one of the staff said that and then the other member of staff said it in a slightly different way. And it was very clear that there was this alignment between them and that they worked very closely together. They both told me too that they consulted with each other out of hours, which I found really interesting as well, that it wasn't just a job for them that they did on the premises and within nursery hours, which are long in themselves. You know, private nurseries will run from maybe 6 a.m. till 6 p.m. But they were taking that interest and that expertise outside of hours, and simple things like talking to each other over Messenger over the weekends. And they were also members of various Facebook groups. So they had a really strong and vested interest in, you know, their practice, and they talked about that together. And that collaboration was a very strong message that came through those interviews, and it was evident within those single interviews as well. As I say, what that would look like in another setting with another group of practitioners, it is a source of conjecture, but in this instance, most definitely, the two were very much in sync with each other. Yeah, certainly. And there weren't any differences. You know, they both have had the same objectives and aims, if you like. And it was interesting in that sense that the idea of hierarchy was completely flattened. No, I wasn't in those instances when I compare the data. I wasn't talking to a manager and then a practitioner. I was actually talking to two educators, just the two members of staff. I mean, obviously, the priorities for the manager were slightly different. She did obviously have to have a wider view of, you know, the practices. You know, she was obviously concerned with the logistics of running a nursery and, you know, the staffing arrangements and so on. But when it actually came to talking about the children and their aims and their beliefs in what they did, they were very much in line.
After you finish your current project, how would you like to see your research continue? Where can the field go from now?
I think for me, two of the interesting things that came out of my research, I mean, there were lots of things that came out of it, but as two areas for development, things I'd like to follow up on, was the role that parents play within that education and care for the children, and also the sense of community. Because I went into my research with an inclusion hat on that centered on the children, but in the course of the research, from what people talked about, inclusion actually wasn't just about what happened in the setting, it was actually about the families outside of the setting. Inclusion wasn't just about children participating in activities and making progress and developing well. It was also about making sure that the families were supported. It wasn't inclusion in the sense of making sure the families are able to attend the meetings. It was actually care and education for the parents as well, so not just the children. So nurseries where I was focusing my research represented a very diverse sort of profile of individuals and families. And that's where that sort of element of inclusion was important. You know, for some families, it was a case of making sure that food was available. It was a case of ensuring that the families had the support if they had mental health problems. So inclusion was much wider in its actuality than I maybe had anticipated at the start of the research. So I think that would be something I'd like to follow up on, because when I talked about, or when I delivered the questions or asked the questions of the staff, they were focused on the children, as I said. But from what came out of the research, a big part of their role involves the families and what they do for families. So that's something I would like to explore, because I didn't ask them how effective they thought they were in their relationships with families. So that's something I'd really like to look at in terms of the comprehensiveness of an early years practitioner's role. And then the second thing about this sense of community, because it wasn't one person working with a child, it was very much this sense of collaboration. And, you know, I looked at self-efficacy from the point of view of one person, but there's a whole field of research on collective efficacy as well.
Thank you very much for coming onto the podcast, Sarah. This truly is a fascinating research topic, and best of luck with your Viva in the upcoming weeks. The next episode of this podcast will be out in 2 weeks' time, so thank you very much for listening.
Well, thanks very much, Luke. It's been great to talk to you and to share a bit of my research. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about our work, please visit the School of Education website. If you have any questions about our research, or if you would like to study with us at the University of Leeds, you can contact the Research Centre Director, Professor Michaelis Kontopoudis, for further details. You will find all relevant links and contact details in the programme description.